Another false start was recorded, and it was the same athlete who had done it. In front of her, she created a perfect race in which Rudy trailed but came home to win in the last 10 meters. What she actually saw, however, was Rudy's disqualification. He was escorted to the side of the track and was made to stand there alone as the remainder of boys stepped forward. They lined up and raced. A boy with rusty brown hair and a big stride won by at least 5 meters. Rudy remained. Later, when the day was complete and the sun was taken from Himmel Street, Liesl sat with her friend on the footpath. They talked about everything else, from Franz Deutsch's face after the 1500 to one of the 11-year-old girls having a tantrum after losing the discus. Before they proceeded to their respective homes, Rudy's voice reached over and handed Liesl the truth. For a while, it sat on her shoulder, but a few thoughts later, it made its way to her ear. Rudy's voice. I did it on purpose. When the confession registered, Liesl asked the only question available. But why, Rudy? Why did you do it? He was standing with a hand on his hip, and he did not answer. There was nothing but a knowing smile and a slow walk that lulled him home. They never talked about it again. For Liesl's part, she often wondered what Rudy's answer might have been had she pushed him. Perhaps 3 medals had shown what he'd wanted to show, or he was afraid to lose that final race. In the end, the only explanation she allowed herself to hear was an inner teenage voice. Because he isn't Jesse Owens. Only when she got up to leave did she notice the 3 imitation gold medals sitting next to her. She knocked on the Steiner's door and held them out to him.
You forgot these.
No, I didn't. He closed the door and Liesl took the medals home. She walked with them down to the basement and told Max about her friend, Rudy Steiner.
He truly is stupid, she concluded.
Clearly, Max agreed, but I doubt he was fooled. They both started work then, Max on his sketchbook, Liesl on the dream carrier. She was in the latter stages of the novel, where the young priest was doubting his faith after meeting a strange and elegant woman. When she placed it face down on her lap, Max asked when she thought she'd finish it.
A few days, at the most.
Then a new one? The book thief looked at the basement ceiling.
Maybe, Max.
She closed the book and leaned back.
If I'm lucky.
The next book. It's not the Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus, as you might be expecting. No, the dictionary comes at the end of this small trilogy, and this is only the second installment. This is the part where Liesl finishes The Dream Carrier and steals a story called A Song in the Dark. As always, it was taken from the mayor's house. The only difference was that she made her way to the upper part of town alone. There was no Rudy that day. It was a morning rich with both sun and frothy clouds. Liesl stood in the mayor's library with greed in her fingers and book titles at her lips. She was comfortable enough on this occasion to run her fingers along the shelves, a short replay of her original visit to the room, and she whispered many of the titles as she made her way along. Under the Cherry Tree, The 10th Lieutenant. Typically, many of the titles tempted her, but after a good minute or two in the room, she settled for A Song in the Dark, most likely because the book was green, and she did not yet own a book of that color. The engraved writing on the cover was white, and there was a small insignia of a flute between the title and the name of the author. She climbed with it from the window, saying thanks on her way out. Without Rudy, she felt a good degree of absence, but on that particular morning, for some reason, the book thief was happiest alone. She went about her work and read the book next to the Amper River, far away from the occasional headquarters of Victor Chemmel and the previous gang of Arthur Berg. No one came, no one interrupted, and Liesl read 4 of the very short chapters of A Song in the Dark,
and she was happy. It was the pleasure and satisfaction of good stealing.
A week later, the trilogy of happiness was completed. In the last days of August, a gift arrived, or in fact was noticed. It was late afternoon. Liesel was watching Christina Müller jumping rope on Himmel Street. Rudi Steiner skidded to a stop in front of her on his brother's bike.
"Do you have some time?" he asked.
She shrugged. "For what?"
"I think you'd better come."
He dumped the bike and went to collect the other one from home. In front of her, Liesel watched the pedal spin. They rode up to Grandestrasse, where Rudi stopped and waited.
"Well?" Liesel asked. "What is it?"
Rudi pointed.
"Look closer."
Gradually they rode to a better position, behind a blue spruce tree. Through the prickly branches, Liesel noticed the closed window and then the object leaning on the glass.
"Is that?"
Rudi nodded. They debated the issue for many minutes before they agreed it needed to be done. It had obviously been placed there intentionally, and if it was a trap, it was worth it. Among the powdery blue branches, Liesel said,
"A book thief would do it."
She dropped the bike, observed the street, and crossed the yard. The shadows of clouds were buried among the dusky grass. Were they holes for falling into, or patches of extra darkness for hiding in? Her imagination sent her sliding down one of those holes into the evil clutches of the mayor himself. If nothing else, those thoughts distracted her, and she was at the window even quicker than she'd hoped. It was like the Whistler all over again. Her nerves licked her palms. Small streams of sweat rippled under her arms. When she raised her head, she could read the title. The Complete Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus. Briefly, she turned to Rudi and mouthed the words,
"It's a dictionary."
He shrugged and held out his arms. She worked methodically, sliding the window upward, wondering how all of this would look from inside the house. She envisioned the sight of her thieving hand reaching up, making the window rise until the book was felled. It seemed to surrender slowly, like a falling tree.
Got it.
There was barely a disturbance or sound. The book simply tilted toward her, and she took it with her free hand. She even closed the window, nice and smooth, then turned and walked back across the potholes of clouds.
"Nice," Rudi said as he gave her the bike. "Thank you."
They rode toward the corner, where the day's importance reached them. Liesel knew. It was that feeling again, of being watched. A voice pedaled inside her, two laps.
"Look at the window. Look at the window."
She was compelled. Like an itch that demands a fingernail, she felt an intense desire to stop. She placed her feet on the ground and turned to face the mayor's house and the library window, and she saw. Certainly she should have known this might happen, but she could not hide the shock that loitered inside when she witnessed the mayor's wife standing behind the glass. She was transparent, but she was there. Her fluffy hair was as it always was, and her wounded eyes and mouth and expression held themselves up for viewing. Very slowly, she lifted her hand to the book thief on the street, a motionless wave. In her state of shock, Liesel said nothing to Rudi or herself. She only steadied herself and raised her hand to acknowledge the mayor's wife in the window. Duden Dictionary. Meaning number 2. Verzeihung. Forgiveness. To stop feeling anger, animosity, or resentment. Related words. Absolution. Acquittal. Mercy. On the way home, they stopped at the bridge and inspected the heavy black book. As Rudi flipped through the pages, he arrived at a letter. He picked it up and looked slowly toward the book thief.
"It's got your name on it."
The river ran. Liesel took hold of the paper. The letter.
Dear Liesel, I know you find me pathetic and loathsome. Look that word up if you don't know it. But I must tell you that I am not so stupid as to not see your footprints in the library. When I noticed the first book missing, I thought I had simply misplaced it. But then I saw the outlines of some feet on the floor in certain patches of the light. It made me smile. I was glad that you took what was rightfully yours. I then made the mistake of thinking that would be the end of it. When you came back, I should have been angry, but I wasn't. I could hear you the last time, but I decided to leave you alone. You only ever take one book, and it will take 1,000 visits till all of them are gone. My only hope is that one day you will knock on the front door and enter the library in the more civilized manner. Again, I am sorry we could no longer keep your foster mother employed. Lastly, I hope you find this dictionary and thesaurus useful as you read your stolen books. Yours sincerely, Ilse Hermann.
We'd better head home, Rudy suggested.
But Liesel did not go.
Can you wait here for 10 minutes?
Of course. Liesel struggled back up to 8 Grunderstrasse and sat on the familiar territory of the front entrance. The book was with Rudy, but she held the letter and rubbed her fingers on the folded paper as the steps grew heavier around her. She tried 4 times to knock on the daunting flesh of the door, but she could not bring herself to do it. The most she could accomplish was to place her knuckles gently on the warmness of the wood. Again, her brother found her. From the bottom of the steps, his knee healing nicely, he said,
"Come on, Liesel. Knock."
As she made her second getaway, she could soon see the distant figure of Rudy at the bridge. The wind showered through her hair, her feet swam with the pedals. Liesel Memminger was a criminal, but not because she'd stolen a handful of books through an open window. "You should have knocked," she thought, and although there was a good portion of guilt, there was also the juvenile trace of laughter. As she rode, she tried to tell herself something. "You don't deserve to be this happy, Liesel. You really don't. Can a person steal happiness, or is it just another internal, infernal human trick?" Liesel shrugged away from her thoughts. She crossed the bridge and told Rudy to hurry up and not to forget the book. They rode home on rusty bikes. They rode home a couple of miles, from summer to autumn, and from a quiet night to the noisy breath of the bombing of Munich. The Sound of Sirens. With the small collection of money Hans had earned in the summer, he brought home a second-hand radio. "This way," he said, "we can hear when the raids are coming even before the sirens start. They make a cuckoo sound and then announce the regions at risk." He placed it on the kitchen table and switched it on. They also tried to make it work in the basement for Max, but there was nothing but static and severed voices in the speakers. In September, they did not hear it as they slept. Either the radio was already half broken, or it was swallowed immediately by the crying sound of sirens. A hand was shoved gently at Liesel's shoulder as she slept. Papa's voice followed it in, afraid.
"Liesel, wake up. We have to go."
There was the disorientation of interrupted sleep, and Liesel could barely decipher the outline of Papa's face. The only thing truly visible was his voice. In the hallway, they stopped.
"Wait," said Rosa.
Through the dark, they rushed to the basement. The lamp was lit. Max edged out from behind the paint cans and drop sheets. His face was tired, and he hitched his thumbs nervously into his pants.
"Time to go, huh?"
Hans walked to him.
"Yes, time to go."
He shook his hand and slapped his arm. "We'll see you when we get back, right?"
"Of course."
Rosa hugged him, as did Liesel.
"Goodbye, Max."
Weeks earlier, they'd discussed whether they should all stay together in their own basement, or if the three of them should go down the road, to a family by the name of Fiedler. It was Max who convinced them. They said it's not deep enough here. I've already put you in enough danger. Hans had nodded.
It's a shame we can't take you with us. It's a disgrace.
It's how it is. Outside, the sirens howled at the houses, and the people came running, hobbling, and recoiling as they exited their homes. Night watched. Some people watched it back, trying to find the tin can planes as they drove across the sky. Himmel Street was a procession of tangled people, all wrestling with their most precious possessions. In some cases, it was a baby. In others, a stack of photo albums or a wooden box. Liesel carried her books between her arm and her ribs. Frau Holzapfel was heaving a suitcase, laboring on the footpath with bulbous eyes and small-stepped feet. Papa, who'd forgotten everything, even his accordion, rushed back to her and rescued the suitcase from her grip.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what have you got in here?" he asked. "An anvil?"
Frau Holzapfel advanced alongside him.
"The necessities?"
The Fiedlers lived six houses down. They were a family of four, all with wheat-coloured hair and good German eyes. More important, they had a nice, deep basement. 22 people crammed themselves into it, including the Steiner family, Frau Holzapfel, Pfiffikus, a young man, and a family named Jensen. In the interest of a civil environment, Rosa Hubermann and Frau Holzapfel were kept separated, though some things were above petty arguments. One light globe dangled from the ceiling, and the room was dank and cold. Jagged walls jutted out and poked people in the back as they stood and spoke. The muffled sound of sirens leaked in from somewhere. They could hear a distorted version of them that somehow found a way inside. Although creating considerable apprehension about the quality of the shelter, they at least could hear the three sirens that would signal the end of the raid and safety. They didn't need a Luftschutzwart, an air raid supervisor. It wasn't long before Rudi found Liesel and was standing next to her. His hair was pointing at something on the ceiling.
"Isn't this great?"
She couldn't resist some sarcasm.
"It's lovely." "Ah, come on, Liesel, don't be like that. What's the worst that can happen, apart from all of us being flattened or fried or whatever bombs do?"
Liesel looked around, gauging the faces. She started compiling a list of who was most afraid. The hit list. 1, Frau Holzapfel. 2, Mr. Fiedler. 3, the young man. 4, Rosa Hubermann. Frau Holzapfel's eyes were trapped open. Her wiry frame was stooped forward, and her mouth was a circle. Herr Fiedler busied himself by asking people, sometimes repeatedly, how they were feeling. The young man, Rolf Schulz, kept to himself in the corner, speaking silently at the air around him, castigating it. His hands were cemented into his pockets. Rosa rocked back and forth, ever so gently.
"Liesel," she whispered, "come here."
She held the girl from behind, tightening her grip. She sang a song, but it was so quiet that Liesel could not make it out. The notes were borne on her breath, and they died at her lips. Next to them, Papa remained quiet and motionless. At one point, he placed his warm hand on Liesel's cool skull. "You'll live," it said, and it was right. To their left, Alex and Barbara Steiner stood with the younger of their children, Emma and Bettina. The two girls were attached to their mother's right leg. The oldest boy, Kurt, stared ahead in a perfect Hitler Youth stance, holding the hand of Karin, who was tiny, even for her 7 years. The 10-year-old Anna Marie played with the pulpy surface of the cement wall. On the other side of the Steiners were Pfiffikus and the Jensen family. Pfiffikus kept himself from whistling. The bearded Mr. Jensen held his wife tightly, and their two kids drifted in and out of silence. Occasionally they pestered each other, but they held back when it came to the beginning of true argument. After 10 minutes or so, What was most prominent in the cellar was a kind of non-movement. The bodies were welded together, and only their feet changed position or pressure. Stillness was shackled to their faces. They watched each other and waited.
Duden Dictionary, meaning number 3. Angst, fear, an unpleasant, often strong emotion caused by anticipation or awareness of danger. Related words, terror, horror, panic, fright, alarm. From other shelters, there were stories of singing Deutschland über alles, or of people arguing amid the staleness of their own breath. No such things happened in the Fiedler shelter. In that place, there was only fear and apprehension, and the dead song at Rosa Huberman's cardboard lips. Not long before the sirens signaled the end, Alex Steiner, the man with the immovable wooden face, coaxed the kids from his wife's legs. He was able to reach out and grapple for his son's free hand. Kurt, still stoic and full of stare, took it up and tightened his grip gently on the hand of his sister. Soon, everyone in the cellar was holding the hand of another, and the group of Germans stood in a lumpy circle. The cold hands melted into the warm ones, and in some cases the feeling of another human pulse was transported. It came through the layers of pale, stiffened skin. Some of them closed their eyes, waiting for their final demise, or hoping for a sign that the raid was finally over. Did they deserve any better, these people? How many had actively persecuted others, high on the scent of Hitler's gaze, repeating his sentences, his paragraphs, his opus? Was Rosa Huberman responsible? The hider of a Jew? Or Hans? Did they all deserve to die? The children? The answer to each of these questions interests me very much, though I cannot allow them to seduce me. I only know that all of those people would have sensed me that night, excluding the youngest of the children. I was the suggestion. I was the advice. My imagined feet walking into the kitchen and down the corridor. As is often the case with humans, when I read about them in the book thief's words, I pitied them, though not as much as I felt for the ones I scooped up from various camps in that time. The Germans in basements were pitiable, surely, but at least they had a chance. That basement was not a washroom. They were not sent there for a shower. For those people, life was still achievable. In the uneven circle, the minutes soaked by. Liesel held Rudy's hand and her mama's. Only one thought saddened her. Max. How would Max survive if the bombs arrived on Himmel Street? Around her, she examined the Fiedler's basement. It was much sturdier and considerably deeper than the one at 33 Himmel Street. Silently she asked her papa, "Are you thinking about him too?" Whether the silent question registered or not, he gave the girl a quick nod. It was followed a few minutes later by the three sirens of temporary peace. The people at 45 Himmel Street sank with relief. Some clenched their eyes and opened them again. A cigarette was passed around. Just as it made its way to Rudy Steiner's lips, it was snatched away by his father. "Not you, Jesse Owens." The children hugged their parents, and it took many minutes for all of them to fully realize that they were alive, and that they were going to be alive. Only then did their feet climb the stairs to Herbert Fiedler's kitchen. Outside, a procession of people made its way silently along the street. Many of them looked up and thanked God for their lives. When the Hubermans made it home, they headed directly to the basement. But it seemed that Max was not there. The lamp was small and orange, and they could not see him or hear an answer. "Max? He's disappeared."
"Max, are you there?"
"I'm here." They originally thought the words had come from behind the drop sheets and paint cans, but Liesel was first to see him, in front of them. His jaded face was camouflaged among the painting materials and fabric. He was sitting there, with stunned eyes and lips. When they walked across, he spoke again. "I couldn't help it," he said.
It was Rosa who replied. She crouched down to face him.
What are you talking about, Max?
He struggled to answer. When everything was quiet, I went up to the corridor, and the curtain in the living room was open, just a crack. I could see outside. I watched, only for a few seconds. He had not seen the outside world for 22 months. There was no anger or reproach. It was Papa who spoke. How did it look? Max lifted his head with great sorrow and great astonishment. There were stars, he said. They burned my eyes. 4 of them, 2 people on their feet, the other 2 remained seated. All had seen a thing or two that night. This place was the real basement. This was the real fear. Max gathered himself and stood to move back behind the sheets. He wished them good night, but he didn't make it beneath the stairs. With Mama's permission, Liesl stayed with him till morning, reading A Song in the Dark, as he sketched and wrote in his book. From a Himmel Street window, he wrote, the stars set fire to my eyes. The Sky Stealer. The first raid, as it turned out, was not a raid at all. Had people waited to see the planes, they would have stood there all night. That accounted for the fact that no cuckoo had called from the radio. The Malking Express reported that a certain flak tower operator had become a little overexcited. He'd sworn that he could hear the rattle of planes and see them on the horizon. He sent the word.
He might have done it on purpose, Hans Huberman pointed out. Would you want to sit in a flak tower, shooting up at planes carrying bombs?
Sure enough, as Max continued reading the article in the basement, it was reported that the man with the outlandish imagination had been stood down from his original duty. His fate was most likely some sort of service elsewhere.
Good luck to him, Max said.
He seemed to understand as he moved on to the crossword. The next raid was real. On the night of September the 19th, the cuckoo called from the radio, and it was followed by a deep, informative voice. It listed Malking as a possible target. Again, Himmel Street was a trail of people, and again, Papa left his accordion. Rosa reminded him to take it, but he refused.
I didn't take it last time, he explained, and we lived.
War clearly blurred the distinction between logic and superstition. Eerie air followed them down to the Fiedler's basement.
I think it's real tonight, said Mr. Fiedler,
and the children quickly realized that their parents were even more afraid this time around. Reacting the only way they knew, the youngest of them began to wail and cry as the room seemed to swing. Even from the cellar, they could vaguely hear the tune of bombs. Air pressure shoved itself down like a ceiling, as if to mash the earth. A bite was taken of Malking's empty streets. Rosa held furiously onto Liesl's hand. The sound of crying children kicked and punched. Even Rudy stood completely erect, feigning nonchalance, tensing himself against the tension. Arms and elbows fought for room. Some of the adults tried to calm the infants. Others were unsuccessful in calming themselves.
Shut that kid up!
Frau Holzapfel clamored, but her sentence was just another hapless voice in the warm chaos of the shelter. Grimy tears were loosened from children's eyes, and the smell of night breath, underarm sweat, and overworn clothes was stirred and stewed in what was now a cauldron swimming with humans. Although they were right next to each other, Liesl was forced to call out,
Mama!
Again,
Mama! You're squashing my hand!
What?
My hand!
Rosa released her, and for comfort, to shut out the din of the basement, Liesl opened one of her books and began to read. The book on top of the pile was The Whistler, and she spoke it aloud to help her concentrate. The opening paragraph was numb in her ears.
What did you say?
Mama roared, but Liesl ignored her. She remained focused on the first page.
When she turned to page 2, it was Rudy who noticed. He paid direct attention to what Liesel was reading, and he tapped his brother and his sisters, telling them to do the same. Hans Hubermann came closer and called out, and soon a quietness started bleeding through the crowded basement. By page 3, everyone was silent but Liesel. She didn't dare to look up, but she could feel their frightened eyes hanging on to her as she hauled the words in and breathed them out. A voice played the notes inside her. "This," it said, "is your accordion." The sound of the turning page carved them in half. Liesel read on. For at least 20 minutes, she handed out the story. The youngest kids were soothed by her voice, and everyone else saw visions of the whistler running from the crime scene. Liesel did not. The book thief saw only the mechanics of the words, their bodies stranded on the paper, beaten down for her to walk on. Somewhere, too, in the gaps between a period and the next capital letter, there was also Max. She remembered reading to him when he was sick. "Is he in the basement?" she wondered. "Or is he stealing a glimpse of the sky again?" A nice thought. One was a book thief. The other stole the sky. Everyone waited for the ground to shake. That was still an immutable fact, but at least they were distracted now by the girl with the book. One of the younger boys contemplated crying again, but Liesel stopped at that moment and imitated her papa, or even Rudy for that matter. She winked at him and resumed. Only when the sirens leaked into the cellar again did someone interrupt her. "We're safe," said Mr. Jensen. "Shh," said Frau Holzapfel. Liesel looked up. "There are only 2 paragraphs till the end of the chapter," she said, and she continued reading with no fanfare or added speed. Just the words. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 4. Wort, word. A meaningful unit of language. A promise. A short remark, statement, or conversation. Related words. Term, name, expression. Out of respect, the adults kept everyone quiet, and Liesel finished chapter 1 of The Whistler. On their way up the stairs, the children rushed by her, but many of the older people, even Frau Holzapfel, even Pfiffikus, how appropriate, considering the title she read from, thanked the girl for the distraction. They did so as they made their way past, and hurried from the house to see if Himmelstreet had sustained any damage. Himmelstreet was untouched. The only sign of war was a cloud of dust migrating from east to west. It looked through the windows, trying to find a way inside, and as it simultaneously thickened and spread, it turned the trail of humans into apparitions. There were no people on the street anymore. They were rumors carrying bags. At home, Papa told Max all about it. "There's fog and ash. I think they let us out too early." He looked to Rosa. "Should I go out to see if they need help where the bombs dropped?" Rosa was not impressed. "Don't be so idiotic," she said. "You'll choke on the dust." "No, no, Saukel, you're staying here." A thought came to her. She looked at Hans very seriously now. In fact, her face was crayoned with pride. "Stay here and tell him about the girl." Her voice loudened just slightly. "About the book." Max gave her some added attention. "The Whistler," Rosa informed him. "Chapter 1. She explained exactly what had happened in the shelter. As Liesel stood in a corner of the basement, Max watched her and rubbed a hand along his jaw. Personally, I think that was the moment he conceived the next body of work for his sketchbook. The Word Shaker. He imagined the girl reading in the shelter. He must have watched her literally handing out the words. However, as always, he must also have seen the shadow of Hitler. He could probably already hear his footsteps coming toward Himmelstreet and the basement, for later. After a lengthy pause, he looked ready to speak, but Liesel beat him to it.
"Did you see the sky tonight?"
"No." Max looked at the wall
and pointed. On it, they all watched the words and the picture he'd painted more than a year earlier, the rope and the dripping sun.
Only that one tonight.
And from there, no more was spoken. Nothing but thoughts. Max, Hans, and Rosa I cannot account for, but I know that Liesel Memminger was thinking that if the bombs ever landed on Himmel Street, not only did Max have less chance of survival than everyone else, but he would die completely alone. Frau Holzapfel's offer. In the morning, the damage was inspected. No one died, but two apartment blocks were reduced to pyramids of rubble, and Rudi's favorite Hitler Youth Field had an enormous bowl spooned out of it. Half the town stood around its circumference. People estimated its depth to compare it with their shelters. Several boys and girls spat into it. Rudi was standing next to Liesel.
Looks like they need to fertilize again.
When the next few weeks were raid-free, life almost returned to normal. Two telling moments, however, were on their way. The dual events of October. The hands of Frau Holzapfel. The parade of Jews. Her wrinkles were like slander. Her voice was akin to a beating with a stick. It was actually quite fortunate that they saw Frau Holzapfel coming from the living room window, for her knuckles on the door were hard and decisive. They meant business. Liesel heard the words she dreaded.
"You go and answer it," Mama said, and the girl, knowing only too well what was good for her, did as she was told. "Is your Mama home?" Frau Holzapfel inquired.
Constructed of 50-year-old wire, she stood on the front step, looking back every so often to view the street.
"Is that swine of a mother of yours here today?"
Liesel turned and called out. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 5. Gelegenheit, opportunity. A chance for advancement or progress. Related words? Prospect, opening, break. Soon Rosa was behind her.
"What do you want here? You want to spit on my kitchen floor now, too?"
Frau Holzapfel was not deterred in the slightest.
"Is that how you greet everyone who shows up at your front door? What a gesindel!"
Liesel watched. She was unfortunate enough to be sandwiched between them. Rosa pulled her out of the way.
"Well, are you going to tell me why you're here or not?"
Frau Holzapfel looked once more at the street and back.
"I have an offer for you." Mama shifted her weight. "Is that right?" "No, not you."
She dismissed Rosa with a shrug of the voice and focused now on Liesel.
"You. Why did you ask for me, then?" "Well, I at least need your permission."
"Oh, Maria," Liesel thought, "this is all I need. What the hell can Holzapfel want with me?"
"I like that book you read in the shelter."
"No, you're not getting it." Liesel was convinced of that.
"Yes?" "I was hoping to hear the rest of it in the shelter, but it looks like we're safe for now."
She rolled her shoulders and straightened the wire in her back.
"So I want you to come to my place and read it to me." "You've got some nerve, Holzapfel."
Rosa was deciding whether to be furious or not.
"If you think..." "I'll stop spitting on your door," she interrupted, "and I'll give you my coffee ration."
Rosa decided against being furious.
"And some flour?" "What are you, a Jew?" "Just the coffee. You can swap the coffee with someone else for the flour."
It was decided, by everyone but the girl.
"Good then, it's done." "Mama?" "Quiet, Saumensch. Go and get the book."
Mama faced Frau Holzapfel again.
"What days suit you?" "Monday and Friday, 4 o'clock. And today, right now."
Liesel followed the regimented footsteps to Frau Holzapfel's lodging next door, which was a mirror image of the Hubermann's. If anything, it was slightly larger. When she sat down at the kitchen table, Frau Holzapfel sat directly in front of her, but faced the window.
"Read,"
she said.
"Chapter 2?
"No, chapter 8. Of course, chapter 2. Now get reading before I throw you out."
Yes, Frau Holzapfel.
Never mind the yes, Frau Holzapfels. Just open the book. We don't have all day.
Good God, Liesel thought. This is my punishment for all that stealing. It's finally caught up with me. She read for 45 minutes, and when the chapter was finished, a bag of coffee was deposited on the table.
Thank you, the woman said. It's a good story.
She turned toward the stove and started on some potatoes. Without looking back, she said,
Are you still here, are you?
Liesel took that as her cue to leave.
Danke schön, Frau Holzapfel.
By the door, when she saw the framed photos of two young men in military uniform, she also threw in a Heil Hitler, her arm raised in the kitchen.
Yes,
Frau Holzapfel was proud and afraid. Two sons in Russia.
Heil Hitler.
She put her water down to boil, and even found the manners to walk the few steps with Liesel to the front door.
Bis morgen?
The next day was Friday.
Yes, Frau Holzapfel. Until tomorrow.
Liesel calculated that there were 4 more reading sessions like that with Frau Holzapfel before the Jews were marched through Mulking. They were going to Dachau to concentrate. That makes 2 weeks, she would later write in the basement. 2 weeks to change the world, and 14 days to ruin it. The Long Walk to Dachau. Some people said that the truck had broken down, but I can personally testify that this was not the case. I was there. What had happened was an ocean sky with white-cap clouds. Also, there was more than just the one vehicle. 3 trucks don't all break down at once. When the soldiers pulled over to share some food and cigarettes and to poke at the package of Jews, one of the prisoners collapsed from starvation and sickness. I have no idea where the convoy had travelled from, but it was perhaps 4 miles from Mulking and many steps more to the concentration camp at Dachau. I climbed through the windshield of the truck, found the diseased man, and jumped out the back. His soul was skinny. His beard was a ball and chain. My feet landed loudly in the gravel, though not a sound was heard by a soldier or prisoner. But they could all smell me. Recollection tells me that there were many wishes in the back of that truck. Inner voices called out to me. Why him and not me? Thank God it isn't me. The soldiers, on the other hand, were occupied with a different discussion. The leader squashed his cigarette and asked the others a smoggy question.
When was the last time we took these rats for some fresh air?
His first lieutenant choked back a cough.
They could sure use it, couldn't they?
Well, how about it, then? We've got time, don't we?
We've always got time, sir.
And it's perfect weather for a parade, don't you think?
It is, sir.
So what are you waiting for?
On Himmel Street, Liesel was playing soccer when the noise arrived. 2 boys were fighting for the ball in the midfield when everything stopped. Even Tommy Müller could hear it.
What is that?
He asked from his position in goal. Everyone turned toward the sound of shuffling feet and regimented voices as they made their way closer.
Is that a herd of cows? Rudy asked. It can't be. It never sounds quite like that, does it?
Slowly at first, the street of children walked toward the magnetic sound, up towards Frau Diller's. Once in a while, there was added emphasis in the shouting. In a tall apartment just around the corner on Munich Street, an old lady with a foreboding voice deciphered for everyone the exact source of the commotion. Up high, in the window, her face appeared like a white flag with moist eyes and an open mouth. Her voice was like suicide, landing with a clunk at Liesel's feet. She had grey hair. The eyes were dark, dark blue.
"Die Juden," she said. "The Jews."
Duden Dictionary, meaning number 6. Elend, misery. Great suffering, unhappiness and distress. Related words, anguish, torment, despair, wretchedness, desolation. More people appeared on the street, where a collection of Jews and other criminals had already been shoved past. Perhaps the death camps were kept secret, but at times people were shown the glory of a labor camp like Dachau. Far up on the other side, Liesel spotted the man with his paint cart. He was running his hand uncomfortably through his hair.
Up there, she pointed out to Rudy. My papa.
They both crossed and made their way up, and Hans Hubermann attempted at first to take them away.
Liesel, he said, maybe...
He realized, however, that the girl was determined to stay, and perhaps it was something she should see. In the breezy autumn air, he stood with her. He did not speak. On Munich Street, they watched. Others moved in around and in front of them. They watched the Jews come down the road like a catalogue of colours. That wasn't how the book thief described them, but I can tell you that that's exactly what they were, for many of them would die. They would each greet me like their last true friend, with bones like smoke, and their souls trailing behind. When they arrived in full, the noise of their feet throbbed on top of the road. Their eyes were enormous in their starving skulls. And the dirt was molded to them. Their legs staggered as they were pushed by soldiers' hands, a few wayward steps of forced running before the slow return to a malnourished walk. Hans watched them above the heads of the crowding audience. I'm sure his eyes were silver and strained. Liesel looked through the gaps, or over shoulders. The suffering faces of depleted men and women reached across to them, pleading not so much for help, they were beyond that, but for an explanation, just something to subdue this confusion. Their feet could barely rise above the ground. Stars of David were plastered to their shirts, and misery was attached to them as if assigned. Don't forget your misery. In some cases, it grew on them like a vine. At their side, the soldiers also made their way past, ordering them to hurry up and to stop moaning. Some of those soldiers were only boys. They had the Führer in their eyes. As she watched all of this, Liesel was certain that these were the poorest souls alive. That's what she wrote about them. Their gaunt faces were stretched with torture. Hunger ate them as they continued forward, some of them watching the ground to avoid the people on the side of the road. Some looked appealingly at those who had come to observe their humiliation, this prelude to their deaths. Others pleaded for someone, anyone, to step forward and catch them in their arms. No one did. Whether they watched this parade with pride, temerity, or shame, nobody came forward to interrupt it. Not yet. Once in a while, a man or woman, no, they were not men and women, they were Jews, would find Liesel's face among the crowd. They would meet her with their defeat, and the book thief could do nothing but watch them back in a long, incurable moment before they were gone again. She could only hope they could read the depth of sorrow in her face, to recognize that it was true and not fleeting.
"I have one of you in my basement," she wanted to say. "We built a snowman together. I gave him 13 presents when he was sick."
Liesel said nothing at all. What good would it be? She understood that she was utterly worthless to these people. They could not be saved, and in a few minutes she would see what would happen to those who might try to help them. In a small gap in the procession, there was a man, older than the others. He wore a beard and torn clothes. His eyes were the colour of agony, and weightless as he was too heavy for his legs to carry. Several times he fell. The side of his face was flattened against the road. On each occasion, a soldier stood above him.
"Steh auf!" he called down. "Stand up!"
The man rose to his knees and fought his way up. He walked on. Every time he caught up sufficiently to the back of the line, he would soon lose momentum and stumble again to the ground. There were more behind him, a good truck's worth, and they threatened to overtake and trample him. The ache in his arms was unbearable to watch as they shook, trying to lift his body. They gave way one more time before he stood and took another group of steps. He was dead. The man was dead. Just give him 5 more minutes, and he would surely fall into the German gutter and die. They would all let him, and they would all watch. Then one human. Hans Hubermann. It happened so quickly. The hand that held firmly onto Liesel's let it drop to her side as the man came struggling by. She felt her palm slap her hip. Papa reached into his paint cart and pulled something out. He made his way through the people, onto the road. The Jew stood before him, expecting another handful of derision, but he watched with everyone else as Hans Hubermann held his hand out and presented a piece of bread, like magic. When it changed hands, the Jew slid down. He fell to his knees and held Papa's shins. He buried his face between them and thanked him. Liesel watched. With tears in her eyes, she saw the man slide farther forward, pushing Papa back to cry into his ankles. Other Jews walked past, all of them watching this small, futile miracle. They streamed by, like human water. That day, a few would reach the ocean. They would be handed a white cap. Wading through, a soldier was soon at the scene of the crime. He studied the kneeling man and Papa, and he looked at the crowd. After another moment's thought, he took the whip from his belt and began. The Jew was whipped 6 times, on his back, his head, and his legs. "You filth! You swine!" Blood dripped now from his ear. Then it was Papa's turn. A new hand held Liesel's now, and when she looked in horror next to her, Rudi Steiner swallowed as Hans Hubermann was whipped on the street. The sound sickened her, and she expected cracks to appear on her papa's body. He was struck 4 times before he too hit the ground. When the elderly Jew climbed to his feet for the last time and continued on, he looked briefly back. He took a last sad glance at the man who was kneeling now himself, whose back was burning with 4 lines of fire, whose knees were aching on the road. If nothing else, the old man would die like a human. Or at least with the thought that he was a human. Me? I'm not so sure if that's such a good thing. When Liesel and Rudi made it through and helped Hans to his feet, there were so many voices. Words and sunlight. That's how she remembered it. The light sparkling on the road and the words like waves breaking on her back. Only as they walked away did they notice the bread sitting rejected on the street. As Rudi attempted to pick it up, a passing Jew snatched it from his hand, and another 2 fought him for it as they continued on their way to Dachau. Silver eyes were pelted then. A cart was turned over, and paint flowed onto the street. They called him a Jew lover. Others were silent, helping him back to safety. Hans Hubermann leaned forward, arms outstretched against the house wall. He was suddenly overwhelmed by what had just happened. There was an image, fast and hot. 33 Himmel Street. Its basement. Thoughts of panic were caught between the in-and-out struggle of his breath. They'll come now. They'll come. Oh, Christ! Oh, crucified Christ! He looked at the girl and closed his eyes. Are you hurt, Papa? She received questions rather than an answer. What was I thinking? His eyes closed tighter and opened again. His overalls creased. There was paint and blood on his hands. And breadcrumbs. How different from the bread of summer. Oh, my God, Liesel. What have I done? Yes, I must agree. What had Papa done? Peace. At just after 11 p.m. that same night, Max Vandenberg walked up Himmel Street with a suitcase full of food and warm clothes. German air was in his lungs. The yellow stars were on fire. When he made it to Frau Diller's, he looked back one last time to number 33. He could not see the figure in the kitchen window, but she could see him. She waved, and he did not wave back. Liesel could still feel his mouth on her forehead. She could smell his breath of goodbye.
I have left something for you, he'd said, but you will not get it until you're ready. He left.
Max!
But he did not come back. He had walked from her room and silently shut the door. The hallway murmured. He was gone. When she made it to the kitchen, Mama and Papa stood with crooked bodies and preserved faces. They'd been standing like that for 30 seconds of forever. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 7. Schweigen. Silence. The absence of sound or noise. Related words? Quiet. Calmness. Peace. How perfect. Peace. Somewhere near Munich, a German Jew was making his way through the darkness. An arrangement had been made to meet Hans Hubermann in 4 days, that is, if he wasn't taken away. It was at a place far down the Amper, where a broken bridge leaned among the river and trees. He would make it there, but he would not stay longer than a few minutes. The only thing to be found there when Papa arrived 4 days later was a note under a rock at the base of a tree. It was addressed to nobody and contained only one sentence. The last words of Max Vandenberg. You've done enough. Now more than ever, 33 Himmel Street was a place of silence, and it did not go unnoticed that the Duden Dictionary was completely and utterly mistaken, especially with its related words. Silence was not quiet or calm, and it was not peace. The Idiot and the Coatmen. On the night of the parade, the idiot sat in the kitchen, drinking bitter gulps of Holzapfel's coffee and hankering for a cigarette. He waited for the Gestapo, the soldiers, the police, for anyone to take him away as he felt he deserved. Rosa ordered him to come to bed. The girl loitered in the doorway. He sent them both away and spent the hours till morning with his head in his hands, waiting. Nothing came. Every unit of time carried with it the expected noise of knocking and threatening words. They did not come. The only sound was of himself. What have I done? He whispered again. God, I'd love a cigarette, he answered. He was all out. Liesel heard the repeated sentences several times, and it took a lot to stay by the door. She'd have loved to comfort him, but she had never seen a man so devastated. There were no consolations that night. Max was gone, and Hans Hubermann was to blame. The kitchen cupboards were the shape of guilt, and his palms were oily with the memory of what he'd done. They must be sweaty, Liesel thought, for her own hands were soaked to the wrists. In her room, she prayed, hands and knees, forearms against the mattress. Please, God, please let Max survive. Please, God, please. Her suffering knees, her painful feet. When first light appeared, she awoke and made her way back to the kitchen. Papa was asleep with his head parallel to the tabletop, and there was some saliva at the corner of his mouth. The smell of coffee was overpowering, and the image of Hans Hubermann's stupid kindness was still in the air. It was like a number or an address. Repeat it enough times, and it sticks. Her first attempt to wake him was unfelt, but her second nudge of the shoulder brought his head from the table in an upward shock. Are they here?
No, Papa, it's me.
He finished the stale pool of coffee in his mug. His Adam's apple lifted and sank.
They should have come by now. Why haven't they come, Liesel?
It was an insult. They should have come by now and swept through the house, looking for any evidence of Jew-loving or treason. But it appeared that Max had left for no reason at all. He could have been asleep in the basement, or sketching in his book.
You can't have known that they wouldn't come, Papa.
I should have known not to give the man some bread. I just didn't think.
Papa, you did nothing wrong.
I don't believe you. He stood
and walked out the kitchen door, leaving it ajar, lending even more insult to injury. It was going to be a lovely morning. When 4 days had elapsed, Papa walked a long length of the Amper River. He brought back a small note and placed it on the kitchen table. Another week passed, and still Hans Hubermann waited for his punishment. The welts on his back were turning to scars, and he spent the majority of his time walking around Molking. Frau Diller spat at his feet. Frau Holzapfel, true to her word, had ceased spitting at the Hubermann's door, but here was a handy replacement.
"I knew it," the shopkeeper damned him. "You dirty Jew-lover!"
He walked obliviously on, and Liesel would often catch him at the Amper River, on the bridge. His arms rested on the rail, and he leaned his upper body over the edge. Kids on bikes rushed past him, or they ran with loud voices and the slaps of feet on wood. None of it moved him in the slightest. Duden Dictionary, meaning number 8. Nachtrauen, regret. Sorrow filled with longing, disappointment, or loss. Related words, rue, repent, mourn, grieve. "Do you see him?" he asked her one afternoon, when she leaned with him. "In the water there." The river was not running very fast. In the slow ripples, Liesel could see the outline of Max Vandenberg's face. She could see his feathery hair and the rest of him.
"He used to fight the Führer in our basement."
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph!" Papa's hands tightened on the splintery wood. "I'm an idiot!" "No, Papa. You're just a man." The words came to her more than a year later when she wrote in the basement. She wished she'd thought of them at the time.
"I am stupid,"
Hans Hubermann told his foster daughter, "and kind, which makes the biggest idiot in the world. The thing is, I want them to come for me. Anything's better than this waiting." Hans Hubermann needed vindication. He needed to know that Max Vandenberg had left his house for good reason. Finally, after nearly 3 weeks of waiting, he thought his moment had come. It was late. Liesel was returning from Frau Holzapfel's when she saw the two men in their long black coats, and she ran inside.
"Papa! Papa!"
She nearly wiped out the kitchen table.
"Papa, they're here!"
Mama came first.
"What's all this shouting about, Zalmensch? Who's here?"
"The Gestapo!"
"Hansi!"
He was already there, and he walked out of the house to greet them. Liesel wanted to join him, but Rosa held her back, and they watched from the window. Papa was poised at the front gate. He fidgeted. Mama tightened her grip on Liesel's arms. The men walked past. Papa looked back at the window, alarmed, then made his way out of the gate. He called after them.
"Hey, I'm right here. It's me you want. I live in this one."
The coatmen only stopped momentarily and checked their notebooks.
"No, no," they told him. Their voices were deep and bulky. "Unfortunately, you're a little old for our purposes."
They continued walking, but they did not travel very far, stopping at number 35 and proceeding through the open gate.
"Frau Steiner?" they asked when the door was opened.
"Yes, that's right."
"We've come to talk to you about something."
The coatmen stood like jacketed columns on the threshold of the Steiner's shoebox house. For some reason, they'd come for the boy. The coatmen wanted Rudy. Part 8. The Word Shaker. Featuring dominoes and darkness, the thought of Rudy naked, punishment, a promise keeper's wife, a collector, the bread eaters, a candle in the trees, a hidden sketchbook, and the anarchist's suit collection. Dominoes and Darkness. In the words of Rudy's youngest sisters, there were two monsters sitting in the kitchen. Their voices kneaded methodically at the door as three of the Steiner children played dominoes on the other side. The remaining three listened to the radio in the bedroom, oblivious. Rudy hoped this had nothing to do with what had happened at school the previous week. It was something he had refused to tell Liesel and did not talk about at home. A grey afternoon. A small school office. Three boys stood in a line. Their records and bodies were thoroughly examined. When the fourth game of dominoes was completed, Rudy began to stand them up in lines, creating patterns that wound their way across the living room floor. As was his habit, he also left a few gaps, in case the rogue finger of a sibling interfered, which it usually did.
"Can I knock them down, Rudy?"
"No."
"What about me?"
"No, we all will."
He made three separate formations that led to the same tower of dominoes in the middle. Together, they would watch everything that was so carefully planned collapse, and they would all smile at the beauty of destruction. The kitchen voices were becoming louder now, each heaping itself upon the other to be heard. Different sentences fought for attention, until one person, previously silent, came between them.
"No,"
she said. It was repeated. "No." Even when the rest of them resumed their arguments, they were silenced again by the same voice, but now it gained momentum.
"Please," Barbara Steiner begged them. "Not my boy."
"Can we light a candle, Rudy?"
It was something their father had often done with them. He would turn out the light, and they'd watch the dominoes fall in the candlelight. It somehow made the event grander, a greater spectacle. His legs were aching anyway.
"Let me find a match."
The light switch was at the door. Quietly, he walked toward it with the matchbox in one hand, the candle in the other. From the other side, the three men and one woman climbed to the hinges.
"The best scores in the class," said one of the monsters. Such depth and dryness. "Not to mention his athletic ability."
Damn it. Why did he have to win all those races at the carnival? Deutscher. Damn that Franz Deutscher. But then he understood.
This was not Franz Deutscher's fault, but his own. He'd wanted to show his past tormentor what he was capable of, but he also wanted to prove himself to everyone. Now everyone was in the kitchen.
He lit the candle and switched off the light.
"Ready?"
"But I've heard what happens there." That was the unmistakable, oaky voice of his father.
"Come on, Rudy, hurry up."
"Yes, but understand, Herr Steiner, this is all for a greater purpose. Think of the opportunities your son can have. This is really a privilege."
"Rudy, the candle's dripping."
He waved them away, waiting again for Alex Steiner. He came.
"Privileges? Like running barefoot through the snow? Like jumping from 10-meter platforms into 3 feet of water?"
Rudy's ear was pressed to the door now. Candle wax melted onto his hand.
"Rumors."
The arid voice, low and matter-of-fact, had an answer for everything.
"Our school is one of the finest ever established. It's better than world-class. We are creating an elite group of German citizens in the name of the Führer."
Rudy could listen no longer. He scraped the candle wax from his hand and drew back from the splice of light that came through the crack in the door. When he sat down, the flame went out, too much movement. Darkness flowed in. The only light available was a white rectangular stencil, the shape of the kitchen door. He struck another match and reignited the candle, the sweet smell of fire and carbon. Rudy and his sisters each tapped a different domino, and they watched them fall until the tower in the middle was brought to its knees. The girls cheered.
Kurt, his older brother, arrived in the room. "They looked like dead bodies," he said.
"What?"
Rudy peered up at the dark face, but Kurt did not answer. He'd noticed the arguing from the kitchen.
"What's going on in there?"
It was one of the girls who answered, the youngest, Bettina. She was 5.
"There are 2 monsters, she said. "They've come for Rudy."
Again, the human child. So much